Okay, we'll get started today on Tuesday that we don't have a snowstorm here in North Dakota and cancel the class. However, I just wanted to get show you something this morning that I've been doing. I heard someone going up at 4:45. I was up at 4 or something because we had a fight with our research aircraft this morning up to northern Maine. And that was frickering. Let's see if this works. Maybe if I start over on the animation. Oh, it was working.
Creative Animation. There you go.
So they have a, we're flying out of the ocean here in this area off of Nova Scotia because there was a satellite overpass, a polar orbiting satellite that comes down. And so it comes down from Nova Scotia to the bottom of this image. You can see the states outlined there. So you know how fast them satellites go? How long do you think it takes to go from Nova Scotia to the bottom of the screen?
Not very.
Not very. 15 minutes? How about 2 minutes? 1 minute. So these satellites move very quickly because they're in orbit. So we do a 20-minute lag. And then we can use 10 minutes on either side of that. And the satellite goes over in less than 2 minutes with a whole scene, but it goes over that leg in like 10 seconds for that 20-minute aircraft leg. So what I'm showing here is a loop every minute of the clouds. So we don't have good radar coverage out there. So, and you can see the sunrise with the visible image coming here. But this is a high resolution mesoscale loop of the storms. And there was some snow up in kind of north of Bangor, Maine. And they flew the satellite overpass, got lined up so that the satellite and the two aircraft were all in a row at a particular time at, let's see, it's 1437 UTC. So how to get them all there and lined up. And so they flew off a, yeah, you can see there was a line like this. And then they went and flew. Let's see if I can get the border here of Maine. They were flying basically right along the northern Maine or northeast border. They went and did a couple legs up there where there was still some snow. So, and it took them like 2 hours to get out there. So they flew around for about 3 hours and 2 hours to come back. So they ran it about an hour ago. So just to show you what I was doing early this morning. And the other pilots had to get up early at 5 a.m. too. But they had to be there at 5, so get used to them early mornings, right? So that's a little bit different. You can see, I rewrote that. I have a link to it on the website. So I put a link on there, make it bigger, to the NOAA 16. And so can anybody tell me why the NOAA 16 satellite, look, you can see them clouds all the time while this other poor orbiting one goes very quickly?
Geostationary.
Yeah, so it's geostationary. So what does that mean in terms of, because
it stays about one spot on the Earth.
Yeah, so it's got to be centered over the equator, and then it looks at the eastern United States. So it's orbiting, but it orbits at the same rate that the Earth orbits. So it stays at the same position. So it's very far out there, like 23,000 miles, where the other ones are only 800 or 700 miles. So a lot closer to, for the poor orbited satellites. But on the poor orbiting one, I came over, they have a radar on it. So then radars don't work if they're out of a geostationary orbit. So I put that up there, and if they were still flying, you could see them on the on the NASA public tracker. I think I pulled it up here, but I was hoping they would still have the flights, but they only give the flights if it's still active. If they land and turn off their system, but you can see pick up where the ER2 landed and the other aircraft.
If you click on it, you can see the flight path.
You can?
Yeah.
Oh, let's see if I click on it. Oh, there it is. Oh, good. So I could do that and must save the last flight path for. Oh, yes. Okay. So I wasn't lying here, right? So there's the flight path for both of the airplanes. And maybe so if I click off of it, will it turn it off? Well, I better not mess it up. But right here is where they had they did a leg up here, and then they came back down, they did some spirals, and then they had a line up here. So this was like a 20, 25 minute leg. So they had a kind of orbit up there, and then they start heading south. So they get in line with the satellite coming over. And they were off like 3-4 kilometers between the two aircraft, but pretty close on that. And then they did this leg here with the ER2 making this big loop, because it goes so fast, it has to go back and loop around to get behind the other aircraft. And then they hide it back. So kind of a long flight up there. But I was busy this weekend trying to get all of our instruments working. So we got all but one of them working. So that's what I was doing this weekend. We had to set up a new data system and everything. So we did get the flight tracks. I learned something. So check out when they're flying NASA airplanes. So I got them links there. And before I forget, you got an assignment due on Thursday. And I think it worked that Julia graded your previous assignment and uploaded it. We had a little bit of an issue with how we got them in there, but I think they worked. So if you want to check now or later, you should see something in there for the first assignment. And I'm working on, so you got a second assignment due on Thursday. You can ask me questions now or on Thursday if you got anything with that. And then I'm working on a third assignment for you on Thursday that's going to be based off of statistical analysis and a paper that one of my graduate students wrote. So I figure I will make you read this paper and see if we can ask some questions for this assignment between that paper and the presentation for today will be your next assignment. Okay, any questions? Okay. Let's see if I can go back and show you. There we go. So we're going to talk about statistical evaluations of weather modification and weather modification programs. So that is the title. So typically when you think of statistical evaluations, you think of comparing some seeded clouds to some unseeded clouds. You know, you go up with your airplane, you seed the clouds,
And then you have some that you leave as unseated. So one of the questions that people would ask is, you know, are the two crowds really the same? Okay. Or were the seated ones, quote unquote, better than the unseated ones? So, you know, when I go up Fry, we're trying to do some targeting of storms in the area. The radar can give you a place to go Fry to. And there's usually a couple of different targets, particularly if you're doing some hydroscopic seeding, which would be typically used at crowd base in a very immature crowds. But if you look at the storms, you can see how well they're developing, you can see how fast they're growing, and people get really good at figuring out which ones are the quote unquote better ones, the ones that have a better chance of producing precipitation. So if you let someone pick the crowds to seed, you know, you have a high probability that they're going to pick the better ones to seed to begin with. So what you can do is you can do a random seed and not seed. Okay, so we did this for some hygroscopic seeding in North Dakota. So we would go out and then we'll pick a crowd that met our criteria. Okay, this is a good crowd that we want to seed. It's a potential target. So, but we got to pick that target before we know if we're going to seed it or not. So we would have this envelope that no one knows what's in it, you know, say, okay, we got a target here. Do we seed this or not? And so then they would read the randomly selected answer. And we would generate these answers beforehand. So we had a list of 50 crowds or something, and they were random. But the other thing we would do is you would kind of want to have not too many crowds be either seed or not seed at one time. Because if you had, you know, four or five of these be one case, that would tend to fall in one day, you know, and then the next day would be different. So you want to have a mix. So there was ways to generate that type of random number so that you don't have a lot of repeats. So you don't have five or six that are seed or non-seed. But you want to randomize them. Of the two populations. But that's very hard to do an operational program, because if you're paying to do the operations, you're gonna want to seed everything that you can. So you have to do that in an experimental research type of program. The other thing that's difficult is a blind experiment and not know if you're seeded or not. So, you know, the people on the aircraft, it's really hard. I mean, we can see the flares burning. You know if you're seeding and stuff. However, after we seeded, or after we had a case that was not a seed case, we would try to go and fly underneath the crowd just like it was a seed case without burning the flares. Okay, because they have our flight tracks, just like on the P3 and ER2, you have the flight track. And so people would analyze this data. If they saw you like flying differently and looked at the flight tracks that were different, then they would know. So this would kind of help to be a blind study so that people that were looking at the data. And so what do you think if we're looking at individual crowds and crowd systems and it's random, maybe it's blind or not, but what do you think we would use to know if it's effective or not? What's the the measurement that we could use. Yeah, so a model precipitation that was formed, if we're doing hydroscopic seeding, it would try to increase the precipitation, right? So how would you, what are ways to measure precipitation? Rain gauge. So do you think we have enough rain gauges to put them right underneath this cloud? People are saying no. So what's another way to measure precipitation?
Agricultural response.
Yeah, you could look at the crops underneath. But then you might have different crops, different cover, lots of different things. So yeah, you look at the radar returns. So when we were doing this, we could use a radar that was on the Kerford Hall, and we could scan and look at that area where we're seeding. And so the radar has limitations. It can only be in a certain area, but it can get some sense of what the precipitation is, the amount, the rate of precipitation of these storms. So we use that to look at the individual storms. And you could do that analysis where you really didn't know, you didn't have to necessarily tell the person looking at the radar if that was seeded or not. And a lot of times we would fly back and forth and around the storm so that the radar tracks would identify the area that we want to look at the precip for. So I might show you that analysis paper also. So people they started doing these type of statistical analysis at the beginning of the history of radar modification. So when did that start? Like when did the programs really begin? Yeah, the 1950s. So after that, they started doing these statistical evaluations. And the results were not very spectacular like they had hoped. And some experiments, or many of them, showed no very noticeable effect on precipitation. And so why might this be? So I list some of them here. There's lots of ways to seed the crowds and lots of techniques and lots of methods and the people. So when we did our hydroscopic seeding, we had a very specific method that we tried to follow. And a very strict criteria. So if you're not very strict on having the right type of crowds and having different people, different pirates, different groups that were seeding them, they could vary a lot in their effectiveness. And as I said, some of them weren't very effective. And then it's hard to sometimes tell what the optimum technique is in terms of the statistics and what to exactly do. So one of the things that you have to do for like the hydroscopic seeding is make sure you get there early enough. So if you're seeding the storms very differently in the life cycle of the clouds, you could be very different. So that can really mess up your statistical analysis. So I went to a lecture the other day and he put up a black box for these black box experiments where you can't see what's inside. So that's how they treat this. You know, you just don't worry about what's going on with the methodology. You just look at the input, which is seeding, and the output, which is the precipitation. So and have no knowledge of what happens in between. So that's a very simplistic methodology, but there could be a lot of different things happening, like, you know, the life cycle of the clouds, how high the cloud tops are, what's the temperature like, what's the environment in terms of the aerosol? What's the crowd-based temperature? What's the crowd-based height? So a lot of different things could be going on, and that could affect your results and how effective it is. So more physically based experiments, you can try to look at the intermediate steps. And before just trying to understand all the different steps involved, you could look at some of the missing variables, some of the important variables that you think are occurring, and reasons to investigate them and note some of them different variables in terms of what was different about the seeded and unseeded cases, maybe why it didn't work. So there's a lot of confounding factors that can affect the effectiveness. And if you look at maybe a physical experiment, a classic one is you try to look at all the different steps that are involved. So you could look at what it changes in the microphysics, how that creates bigger particles, how that makes rain. And so there's a big long chain, but it's very difficult to get all them parameters in an experiment. So it's only now we're getting some of the details. Another thing to look at in terms of statistics, they work best a lot of times for analyzing things that are normally distributed. So that's your normal bell-shaped curve where you have a mean value where it's the peak, and then same distribution types on either side of that. So a lot of the statistics work better when you have that type of distribution. So if you're trying to do something like rain enhancement or hail suppression, do you think we have a bell-shaped curve? Yes, no? So, is it always, the rain rates and the rain amounts always about the same amount? Or do you get some of these big storms and heavy amounts? And
I think it depends on what date range you're looking at, how far out you want to look at.
Okay. Well, let's look at precip, because that's the next thought I have. Not too far. There's my precip. So here's a hourly rain rate in millimeters per hour. So this is amount of rain you would get at a location, be it measured with a rain gauge or a radar. Could sum up the amount. You could look at snowfall amounts. They would be equally distributed like this. So typically they're more what we call log normally distributed, where you have a whole bunch at the beginning here, that's light precip. And then you have some heavy type of rain events. So a lot of times these are the convective storms where you got big, very dense convective cells that make a lot of rain and very quickly. But then you got this big area where you got lighter, more stratus, light precipitation. So the snow is not quite as bad, But there's bands of heavy snowfall too. So it's very non-bell-shaped, non-Gaussian. And so this makes it more difficult to analyze in a statistical sense. So that's one of the problems that we have. So when we do these type of statistical analysis, usually they talk about hypothesis testing. And you basically have two sets of data. You have a seeded set, non-seeded set, you know, one that's treated and one that's not. And you want to really have know if you have a difference between these two sets, right? So you get a whole set of storms, you get an area where you seeded, and is there a difference between these two sets? And is that difference more than what you can be explained by chance, right? So anybody, so it's like a statistics, like if you want to, you know, throw the dice and you get a distribution, you're going to, if you throw it enough times, you probably get a random distribution. But if you do that just a couple times, you can have very weighted distributions. So this is a big secret. If you ever go gambling, the house always makes sure that distributed over a long time period, it's going to be a bell-shaped distribution. So if you really want to beat the house, how do you do that? You pray once and you win, or you pray a few times. So if you win at the beginning, stop, okay? But of course, that's what they don't want you to do, right? So they design everything to keep you praying. Because if you just went and did it a couple times, you know, you could do that and you could win out. So they want you to come back again or pray for a longer time. So they got a whole psychological strategy of how to do that. So if you want to go to Vegas and do that, just pray a few, have the amount that you're going to do. And if you win, stop. And then you can, so that's what can happen if you have a distribution that has just a few points in it, but we don't do that for the cloud seeding. You know, to really have a experiment, you have to have enough cases to have a really good distribution that couldn't happen by random chance. So usually in these, we formulate a hypothesis. And usually what we want to do is prove what they call the null hypothesis. So what you want to do is generally state in a way that will make it, if it's rejected, there's likely a difference between the two cases. So you could write a null hypothesis that says that the two distributions, for example, one seed and one non-seed, are the same. You can assume how that's distributed, but what you try to do is prove that that is not true, okay? That these two distributions are different, okay? So I have the, I'm gonna have it. Yeah, so I went back to this one. So here's two distributions, both randomly kind of normal, but how much of a spread between them two distributions do you need before you can really say that they're different? And how different are they? Okay, so we want to know and reject the hypothesis that they're the same at some confidence level. So one way we do that is with a statistical significance level, which you should state beforehand, but sometimes we don't. A lot of times we, in atmospheric science at least, we'll take a confidence level of 5% to reject the Nihal hypothesis, which means that there's only a 5% chance that the two data sets are from the same population. So basically that means there's a 95% chance that they're from different ones, but the way we state it is that there's only a 5% chance that they're from the same population, that there's no difference. So sometimes we use 10%, sometimes we use 1%. And we call the, I guess 95 is 2 sigma, 2 standard deviations away from that. So some physicists, when they have to discover a new particle or something, they have to use 5 sigmas. So they're very conservative, but they have, you know, a basics that they're trying to, like, fundamental laws. Here we got a lot of variability. So it's harder to see the other things we can't control for in the real atmosphere, as opposed to a laboratory experiment. So 95% is a pretty good one, but sometimes we get 98, you know, we get something that would be in 94, 93, something that's better than 10%. And then you say, well, you're pretty close, right? So, you know, it's not a hard and fast rule of how good you want to be. And you could have more data, you could get a little bit more data, but you can't, you know, how much experimentation, how many flights can you do to keep getting more and more statistical numbers? The other thing that comes in is the sample size. Usually with a bigger sample size, or almost always with a bigger sample size, you'll get better statistics. So for larger effects as compared to natural variability, number would be small if you have a large effect. For smaller effects, you need a larger number. But it also depends on how good the samples are. Operation programs seed everything, so there's no unseeded cases to analyze. Sorry for my, got my hole there. No cases. But it's counterintuitive in the sense that, you know, you have to have good samples. And a lot of times getting good samples is better than getting more samples. So you can go out and you can seed crowds that really have no potential to make precipitation, and the seeding doesn't have any effectiveness at increasing that, right? I mean, if there has to be a crowd there. You can just go out and seed plain air, and we know it's not gonna be effective. If you add them cases in, it's not gonna help. So there's a balance between having a lot of cases and having good cases. So a lot of times you can't just add numbers of cases. It's better to add good cases, but that requires that you know something about how effective you're gonna be and what is the methodology. So if you don't know exactly what's gonna go on, the theory of how it works is gonna be hard. So there's a balance. You don't want to just seed everything. So what can you do? So the paper I'm going to have you look at is on the precipitation evaluation of North Dakota. So if they seed all the storms, where can you get the unseeded cases from? So history, that's what I put this slide up. So what you could do is you could look at historical data. Is every year going to have the same amount of precip? No. I mean, if every year was about the same, the farmers would not complain about the weather, right? You know, so you have some years that are dry, some years that are wet. So the history is not going to tell you too much, but sometimes we can use covariance as an indicator of how much or less these years are. So, and you have a control area where there's no seeding. So you really want to have something that links the seeded area to the non-seeded area. Okay, so that way you can make sure that the controls are good. Okay, because one of the things you could do statistically is just pick an area that's going to have less precip naturally than a control area. I mean, for your control area, if it's going to have less and then the seeding has more naturally, then it's going to show like the seeding is having an effect. This is why how you pick the control area. So here's an example of a historical one. The scatter plot shows normalized monthly targets. In here, and you can look at the control area and the target areas. And you can look at historical ones. And so, you know, they are more that are above the regression line than below it. So basically, if you just look at these and they're the same, you can see that there's an increase in precipitation. And this is one of the first studies historically of what they've done. Is that you got your target areas that are above the control areas. So they've done this, but the question is, you know, how good are the controls? And also the samples have not been taken randomized in terms of when did you start the seeding and when did you not, right? So the best thing to do, right, is start an operational program when there's a drought, get it up and running, take some time. Well, then historically, if it comes back, you know, it might just naturally improve the rain. So it depends when on the cycle that you start your programs. So the times are not chosen randomly. So because of that, it's hard to evaluate operational programs. So you can try to do some experiments where you have an area and you can select different areas that you would seed, you know, or not seed. Okay, so instead of picking cases like individual crowd, you pick big areas. Okay, I'm gonna seed this area or not seed that one. And randomly select which days you seed and which ones you don't. So, did I? So, but you could have the storms go into one area versus the other area sometimes. So they do this random crossover. So you have two areas, and this is really a little bit more effective where you have big storms, something like out west, we have big snowstorms, kind of like the example I had today with the snowstorm in Maine. You know, you got a big storm that can affect both of your areas. So the storm is similar. And then you can select one of the two areas at random to see. So you kind of think that the storm is going to affect both areas the same, as opposed to having individual storms in either one of the areas that could be quite different. So in this sense, the seeded and unseeded areas should be pretty similar. And this is can be a lot more effective than than just looking at and deciding which individual storms to seed. So you seed one area versus the other area. So that's a lot more effective. The other thing, once you've figured out these areas that you wanted to seed, a lot of times we like to have some ratio or something that will tell us, you know, simply what it is. So. And the ratios can hide a lot of the medians of the data. So for example, if you just took a ratio of the seed and non-seed cases that are given here. So, you know, you have seed cases and there's this non-seed cases. And so you can have two of these. You have two storms. One has 0.01 inches, the other one has 0.1. For the seed cases, the non-seed cases are given here. And you can have the total amount between the two cases come out to be the same. But the ratios are a lot different because you're basically taking everything and you normalize it because it's not distributed just around one. You can have a very lot of storms that are very small for the two cases. So the ratios can be very different and misleading. So a simple ratio doesn't give you a good feeling of what it is, like you would expect. And if you just do the simple ratio of seed to non-seed, it's not just, if you get a ratio of 1.25, that's a 25% increase. So. So we got problems with statistics with the distribution. Things can change. And because there's so much natural variability, it could take a lot of data to get the distribution well represented there. So, and it depends, you know, lots of them as in like years, decades of measurements. So most people lose you know, what's the word? You get tired, you know, you do it for a couple of years. Oh, am I seeing the results? Well, you got to do this for another few, 4 or 5 more years, particularly if you don't get good years. So they did this in Wyoming. They did so many years, and then they extended it, and they still didn't get enough data that really shows the difference. So you spend a whole lot of money, you take a, you know, 5 or 10 years to do this, and you still don't necessarily get the statistics because of the measurements, because of the weather, a lot of things that can happen. But if you tell someone this is going to take 30 years, well, they're going to be like, that's not going to help me. So you got to be somewhat realistic, but also get some data in a useful time. But it's very difficult with all the variability that we have in the atmosphere. There are more sophisticated tests, non-randomized, non-parametric statistical tests. They help. You can do one of them as a ranking test. You know, look at the amount of precip for each storm and rank these from smallest to largest. But due to ranking of the seeded and non-seeded storms, are they different? Do they rank up differently in terms of how they go about with the seeding? So instead of statistics, you can look at the ranks of the data. And I think I mentioned this earlier. One of the problems with the statistics is, does the seeding happen more effectively under certain conditions than others? And might it actually decrease if you seeded it under some conditions? You know, what kind of cases, you know, would you look at that might have some differences in the seed and non-seed? Crop top temperatures, if they get very cold, might have a difference. So you might want to look at cases that are stratified by cold crop top temperatures and warm crop top temperatures. So there are some other results. I already mentioned, you know, seeding earlier rate in the life cycle. That's what happened to the Saudi Arabia project. They had all the seed cases late in the storm cycle, life cycle. So the statistics doesn't work out well. There may be some variables that you haven't measured or you don't know about that can affect these. So even if you know, how do you know that these are really the same conditions? And that's the problem with the statistical studies. So a lot of times you combine the statistical studies with other more physical analysis so that hopefully they tell you about the same thing. So, and you can use the statistics a little bit for something where you want to get to some economic evaluation. You know, it's harder to do that for non-statistical studies. Okay, long talk it. Questions? I should take a break. Statistical evaluations, is it the way to go? Lots of problems. Okay. Questions? Think of some questions. Let me see if this is going to work. I'll try to wake you up a little bit more. Let me pull up a video here. Oops. Okay, I got to turn down, before I start this, let me turn down the volume here.
it doesn't get too loud. And I talked a little bit about this. Let's see if this will load up. Open. Okay. This is a problem. Yeah. And of course, they don't have the. So it won't open in that. Open web, other. Oh, they have VLC. Let's see if that works. Pretty sure that works. Yes, continue. Oh, it's working. Now I have to put it on the video where you can see it.
Okay, this is, I'll show you, we don't sound first.
Maybe I should. Now that I know the video is going to work, maybe I'll turn it up a little bit. And see if this is. Oh, that's pretty good.
Now you can see the engine. So this is on a King Air 200 research aircraft when we're flying in Saudi Arabia. And so this is looking through the, from the above where the co-pilot sits, right? On the right side. So we get into a storm where you see a lot of rain and stuff. So this is a lesson to the, I was flying with a Saudi scientist that didn't think he should put his seatbelt on, but we made him. So he just left it very loose, like it's not on. And so I saw him about a year ago and he still remembers his flight on it. So what happens is we are in a downdraft area where you have all the rain and the storm coming down. And when you see, you want to be on the upgrowth side of the storm. So instead of just going around the storm to get to one, we kind of went through it. So there you hear that big bump. So you guys missed that, right? All right, let me back it up here. Well, if I turn it up a little bit, you can see so I'll do it again and you can get a little bit more of the volume here. So you kind of heard that, but you didn't see what was happening in the so the pirates are laughing. That was pretty fun, right? So you can listen to the whole video if you want to go to the link. But we come out to the front side of the storm. And so we went from the downdraft region, right, and we hit the updraft region at the right there. We had that big bump. And so, of course, he went and hit his head on the roof and stuff and on that. So either don't fly between them two regions or make sure you have your seatbelt on. And then we go in there. So you always got to be safe and prepared, right? That's why we do that. So that's my video for telling the scientist that you're just sitting there watching the work being done and there's no reason to be up. Wear your seatbelt. Or when the flight scientist asked the pilot to go through that storm and you shouldn't. So usually it's not that bad because we're just seated in the updraft region. That was my little video, so you can go and listen to what the pirates had to say. I think if you turn it up at the end, like, that was nice or something. So, but he still remembers that fight.
and stuff. So that's my crowd video here for the one. So I will give you a quote unquote task to do between now and Thursday. And since I imagine 90% of you won't do it, I will have an assignment on Thursday. You'll have to answer some questions. So, but if you want to get ahead on the assignment, I have a PDF here. If you click on that PDF, this is the paper that they've been promising will be published. So, and since we talked about statistical analysis, Matt Capito is a graduate student that worked with me and another professor here in the department, and the Detwire. So, and the title tells you what the paper is about, right? Precipitation Evaluation, North Dakota Crop Modification Project. So that's what they've been doing here in North Dakota. And we use rain gauge observations. So I will come up with some questions related between the type of evaluation we did here and how this works back to the statistical analysis. And a lot of times, I know when you do these things, it's kind of like reading a manual for a new airplane or something. You know, they're big and long, right? So you necessarily don't want to read the whole thing. So one of the things we do with reading this, you can read the abstract, which is nice and short, to get an idea of what it is. So let's see here. We have a couple. I don't have this memorized, but so it talks about the program that was ran since 1976. So we evaluated data from 77 to 2018. So we've done the analysis, we wrote the paper, and it's like 4 years later. And so we used target areas that were seeded and these counties. And there were control areas that were next to them that weren't seeded. So we try to evaluate this between the target and control areas. So remember, what's the problem with that? And then there's problems with the historical data too. So you could try to do like a target control analysis, or you could do a historical data. So we try to combine both of them, where we would use the preceding data as kind of a control to see how it changed. So there's some statistics in here for double ratios. So we looked at 8 different ratios. 2 of them showed that had a 95% confidence that it was above 1, so that there was some seeding effect. So that's your significance level. But we look at 8 different ones and we only find 2 of them that have this high confidence level. So, and then we say what the ratio is, that the average ratio is 1.03. So that's a pretty small effect of the overall precipitation. But remember, they also are primarily doing this for hail suppression. So they're not actually primarily trying to increase precipitation. We just want to see what it was. So some little bit of analysis there. So I think I'm going to try to make you look at that. So read the abstract and
Then the other thing you can skip to is look at pictures. We look at the figures, and I can put this in the slide, but this is another of cases. In our case, we're using rain gauges. And we go back to 1950. So there's only like five or six of these rain gauges. And then once the program started, they sponsored a bunch of people, and the farmers were interested. So they all started out, I'll take the measurement. So there was a lot of different ones to begin with, and then they kind of went down, went back up. But you have a lot more rain gauge data. So that can also affect our analysis of where these measurements are, how many there are. And then of course we give you, I think you saw before where we had the seeding areas, which are target areas where we seeded, and then the control areas. So a lot of our control areas are upwind or closer to the mountains. So, you know, you got the Rocky Mountains here. So if you look at the natural precip, it will decrease. So we have it in our paper here, but this is another plot showing the 30-year average precipitation with the reds in the low precip, which is out west, and then you get more heavier precip to the east. So if we were to look at controls here compared to ones as they move, you know, that is going to naturally show that there's more precip. So if you see here versus up there, so we have to control for that. We have to use a parameter look at that. And a lot of data tables with that, which is hard to read and look at. But this is one of our statistics, looking at the double ratio. And the idea is that if it was really just a no change between the seeding, we would have something right around one, but you move it over. So that movement is indicative of a seeding effect. The double ratios is kind of like a normalization or a control for the ratio. So, and there's only a, you can also look at the distribution. So what type of distribution is this? Is this, so this is a normal Gaussian type of distribution, right? So, the small percentage, you know, looking at this stuff over here would be the case that could be the percentage or the amounts that weren't necessarily changed. So there's a small percentage that it would not have been changed. So take a look at that. It's pretty good. They still have a little bit of editing to do with this, but I wanted you to take a look at it. And then I will give you an assignment on Thursday to ask you some questions about statistical analysis and maybe looking at this paper, because so it's kind of you're using your critical thinking skills and thinking about what the results are. And since this is North Dakota, I think this is a appropriate one to look at. So I know if I just tell you to read this and stuff, you probably won't. So I'll make you have an assignment to write a few sentences about a couple questions. So, okay. Unless anybody has any questions about that. Yes, we kind of started on time, so getting a little bit more reasonable. But take a look at it, see if you can read it. There's a link to it there. You should be able to pull that off the website and do the other lecture, the other assignment on Thursday, and then I'll try to think about a test here pretty soon, since we're assuming that we're not going to have any more snow days. So, my what a distribution one. Yeah, this is the rain.
Those spider areas, especially the one down south of that fog.
Fog would be
limited number of observations. But if you do it over this period, it's kind of
where is this one
right here? It is, but because I think there's some topography for these ones in here too. It's very very subtle topography on some of that stuff. But I don't know how to explain all of them and stuff. So, let me stop the recording here. Control. Let's see here. I gotta stop the share. Stop sharing. Okay, I did that. And then I gotta stop. There's too many things to have to do. Stop the recording. Yes. Okay.
Is there any possibility to move the presentation directly where we want it moved?
That's the thing too, is if you're talking about moving it, right?
Yeah, moving.
So right,
it's a one of the problems we had, like if you look at the
map here, right? Where they were doing the seeding. You know, you have Bowman here, and we can't use these counties here that are directly downwind as controls because the storm's coming like this. So even if you see here, there's downwind effects.
You can calculate the wind speed and how to move.
But yeah, so if you see here, you can affect these ones to some extent. You know, and so this one here, in between here, we kind of use this as a control in buildings, right? They're seeding up here, they're seeding down here, but the storms wouldn't necessarily move like north to south, you know.
Yeah, but you use that wind direction, right?
Yeah, but
France moves, so
yeah. So it's really hard to, you know, if you increase it in one area, then, you know, some people worry, well, do you decrease it downward, right? It's like wind farms do this, right? If you have a wind farm, right, and you build another one downwind, it's going to decrease it. So they have these problems, right? They have one wind farm, and someone builds another wind farm just upwind of it. You know, they will actually steal some of the
Because they're removing that. The precept is
to the partially precipitation, they will still.
Well,
and will,
it works differently. The precept works differently in the window. So the reason is because of the, you don't remove a lot of the moisture from the atmosphere when you do cloud storm. The storms don't remove a lot of the precip. So if you have a storm upwind, there's a lot of moisture still available. See, the wind farms will remove a lot of that energy. You know, they can remove a significant amount, but the precip, you don't remove as much of the amount that's available. Okay, so it's, you know. And of course, the storm dynamics are different. So if you usually you don't have, it's complicated, you know. So it's a lot different than that. So,
but. And there's the evidence, real evidence that affects wind farms for precipitation, right? It's how climate change.
For precipitation or for?
Yeah, for precipitation and